Welcome, everybody, to another Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom, where we examine the art and science of games. Unfortunately, James couldn't make it to the recording this week, but we have a great cast. We're going to be talking about platformers, specifically the platformer mascot genre, which was one of the most popular genres during the mid-90s, early 2000s, with the likes of Spyro, Ratchet & Clank, Crash Bandicoot, and so many more. And to help me talk about tonight, we have one of the creators of said platformer game. Please welcome to the cast the lead designer or creator of the game Voodoo Vince, Clayton Kozlark.
Hello.
Hi, Clayton. It's great to have you on, and I hope I just didn't butcher your last name too much there.
You absolutely did fine.
Thank you. We were just talking about before the cast, we are recording this in the just about the second week of May right now, and it is full spring and allergy season. So I'm sure I will be coughing and losing my voice at least three or four times over this next cast.
I'll do the same thing as well. So this is going to get really fun.
Of course, it'll be great for the folks listening. Well, so it'll be great if both our voices just like go at the exact same time, so no one can talk.
Just 10 minutes of wheezing.
Yes, exactly. So, how are you doing today, Clayton?
I'm doing really well, Max.
Yep. It's great to have you on. We've been talking about setting this up for a few weeks now. I know for those of you listening, the remake of Voodoo Vince, it's been out, I think, for... When did it launch? I think, was that in April?
Yeah, it would have been the 18th of April. So... Just coming up on a month before you know it.
Cool. And by the time this cast goes, it will probably be longer than that. But
yeah.
I think we're going to have a great discussion nonetheless, because the platformer mascot genre really did hit its like peak in the late 90s, early 2000s. So I guess to get the ball rolling then, obviously, besides telling people that you are the creator of Voodoo Vince, for those who didn't play the game or don't know you, would you mind talking a little bit about your background when it comes to the game industry?
Yeah, sure. I've been in the game industry for about, over 25 years now, and started off doing art, an animator, background art, things like that. And this was in the glory days of the side-scroller. Mm-hmm. So working on games for mostly like the Super Nintendo, Sega Genesis, and that was at a small development house in kind of the Seattle area, and kind of rolled on from there to work at Squaresoft, again, mostly doing animations and backgrounds for their Secret of Evermore project that came out of the studio they had in Redmond for a while, and then was at a place called Cave Dog Entertainment, mm-hmm. where with my friend Chris Taylor, we worked on an RTS game called Total Annihilation. So it's been kind of a gamut of a lot of different things, everything from, you know, RPGs to RTS games and some really, really old platformers that were back on when, you know, it was on seriously like giant pixels. Yeah. And stuff like that. I think I'd always had a love for that particular kind of genre. I just was a huge fan of what I'd seen as they sort of emerged into 3D, especially with Mario 64 and games like that. So, I played all those tirelessly, just loved that whole thing. So it's around 2000 or so. And I was just sort of thinking about maybe what I wanted to do next after I was done with Cave Dog. And so I was sitting around and drew a picture of a little guy with a giant eye, and started thinking about the possibilities of a character who maybe had a little, you know, twist, a little something, you know, that would make him stand out. And the idea that it'd be a Voodoo doll, and maybe you could do bad things to him, that maybe that could be entertaining. And that's sort of what led to the pitch and the developing of the idea for Voodoo Vince at the time. Mm-hmm. And then I went on and built up a studio, hired a team, and we made Voodoo Vince. And then it was out in September of 2003. Mm. So, you know, 13 and a half years ago, as of right about now. So, mm-hmm. yeah. And then I just kept going with the stuff with that company, with Beep, for like another 4 or 5 years, mostly doing little puzzle games, download games, and some things like that for a while. I've also done a few, you know, mobile games, Never really went back to platformers, even though I love them. You know, I always wanted to work on more of them. But as you say, you know, the times change, tastes change, even the way we design and think about our games change a lot, you know, as they go by. And so I've worked on tons of other stuff. I've been at Microsoft now for 8 years and currently a creative director in their first party publishing group. So, you know, I get to work with, you know, the partners who are developing titles with Microsoft. And that's been really, really cool. We get to talk with game designers about game design every single day, which is pretty great. So, yeah, that's, I guess that brings us up to date. And then, then about a year ago, I thought, hey, how about, you know, maybe I should remaster this Vince game. And I talked about it maybe, even a year ahead of time and sort of bugging people here at Microsoft. And I finally decided one day, I just have to go do it on my own. It's one of those things like where, you know, it's, you could call it a cult hit, you know, the way I put it is these days, I think a lot of character platformers are beloved, but not popular. So there's this audience that wants them, that likes them, that wants to play them. And, I also was kind of sad because Vince never got backwards compatibility. I think it was one of the only first party titles from that era that never got backwards compatibility. So to me, it was sort of a personal mission to say, well, let's reconstitute it. Let's bring it back. And really to me, it was a restoration of the original, just to bring it back and make it playable again, make it just to be able to run on, you know, current day platforms was kind of my goal. And I've added a couple of guys, a couple of contractors basically who I just worked with in my spare time in the evenings and weekends, and just basically self-developed and published the remaster of Voodoo Vince independently through the ID program with Xbox.
Interesting. And a lot of really interesting parts to talk about there, Clay, and especially regarding backwards compatibility. For fans of Game Wisdom, you know that I am definitely a big supporter on preserving video games. And again, the challenge of trying to keep these games available beyond just their original shelf life.
Yes.
And we have been seeing some very interesting cases going back and forth over the last few years of trying to, again, preserve video game history. I know I talked to creators of this group in, I think, the UK. I think this was last year. I can't remember their name, unfortunately, who were talking about preserving video games. Of course, there's the big ones like GOG. Mm-hmm. And we've been trying to, I guess, see more of this on the consoles, but it's always been almost a uphill battle in terms of trying to preserve things. I know when we talk about like PlayStation, for instance, like it's always weird about some models were backwards compatible with PlayStation 3, some weren't. And obviously, working at Microsoft, you know about some of the challenges when it came to the Xbox and getting those games to be backwards compatible. We've been seeing like it almost like in pushes, like almost like waves of backwards compatibility with older Xbox games throughout the 360 and then the Xbox One shelf life.
Yeah. It's an interesting landscape of kind of like different efforts, I think, on different platforms and for different reasons to bring back games. There was a certain advantage that like on the 360, it was like a patch, you know, you would patch the game and it would run on the 360. That wasn't possible with Vince though, because our engine was just too funky. It was a completely, you know, we built our own engine for the game, and that meant it could do certain things really well, and it took advantage of the original hardware, but it was, you know, looking for things that just didn't exist anymore on the 360, which meant to run it all, we had to go a lot deeper. I mean, the game even compile or run at all, you know, we had to really go in there and just, you know, scrap a lot of the original engine completely to do the remaster. And then, you know, obviously the stuff on the One has certain advantages. It's a more powerful device, and there are certain ways to certain really awesome, you know, I think techniques that Microsoft came up with to be able to run again, like the 360 generation could move forward. But I think when you get back beyond a certain period in time, those kind of like common platforms, those common practices and tools and things didn't exist yet. You know, a lot of stuff really, or a lot of stuff really was like one-offs or custom made. Mm-hmm. And I think I made the comment a while ago that, you know, it's so amazing you could watch a movie from 100 years ago, but you can barely play anything that was made more than 20 years back, you know, in games. And so, I'm kind of, so Vince was more like that kind of archaeology where we had to really go in there and just, you know, go really deep on how the game, you know, runs to kind of reconstitute it and bring it back.
Yeah. And that's always one of those interesting challenges when it comes to backwards compatibility that I know for a lot of consumers that it's not really something they think about. When they see like an older game, they think, well, it's less graphically intensive, so surely it must be easier to port or easier to revive. But that is usually not the case. I've spoken to a few people about backwards compatibility, but we haven't really had we've had several, I guess, discussions about, but it's been a while since we had a really good sit down on the topic. Mm-hmm. But there is so much more that goes into it, especially as you said, for these older games. Not only is it from an engine point of view, but then there's the ever popular who owns the IP quest that can happen when you're trying.
Yeah, it's a quagmire of stuff. And, you know, I was thinking back to when I briefly worked on the sort of game room arcade emulator here at Microsoft that came out on the 360. Oh, yeah. And that was really, really interesting because I think some of the material was easy to get. There were some publishers that were still around that you could do business with, and some just didn't exist anymore. Some assets, some of the archiving of those games was way better in the hands of the fans and enthusiasts than it was from the companies themselves. Sometimes it was, and that was a magnified version of that because you're going back even further in time for that. But yeah, it's just like sorting out not only the technology, but the rights and all that stuff gets really interesting when you get in there.
Oh, yes. I've spoken to Forestlight Studios, who do the Pinball Arcade, if you've heard of that one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we've spoke several times, and I remember when we had our conversation about the nightmare was to secure the rights for the Addams Family pinball machine. And just the the never-ending quest they had to go on just to get everybody to sign off on that one machine.
Yeah. And
it's just crazy when you think about it.
It really is. And it gets even more crazy when it's something like that is across other media as well.
Yes.
I mean, because not only do you have, of course, the rights to the Addams Family, you have Charles Addams estate, original cartoon. And it's possible, and I've seen this with other IP, that, maybe someone else owns the rights to that iconic music. It definitely keeps, it can really keep lawyers busy.
Oh, yes. And when we start talking about video games as well, it gets even crazier. One of the things that we've especially seen over the last few years has been cases when licensed music gets factored into things, such as with Grand Theft Auto, and even with popular IPs. There was something last year for 1 second I have to cough. Sorry about that. Like I said, it is allergy season here.
No problem.
With the remake of Castle of Illusion, Mickey Mouse's Castle of Illusion, that it was taken off of digital stores because they no longer had the copyright or the licensing for Mickey Mouse. And they tried to update the game and it ran into problems like that.
Oh, yeah. 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 The Disney properties especially get pretty intense around that stuff because they come from such a wide span of history. Also, the contributors or even the stuff that they licensed may have its own whole separate story. When it's all said and done, you know, we want to be able to bring these games back, especially and keep playing them. Because I agree with that it's kind of part of this heritage we all have. Mm-hmm. And it'd be a shame if people couldn't experience them. You know, and it's funny going to they had a retrospective. At the it used to be called the EMP. I forget what it's called now in Seattle. There, it's that place right by the Space Needle that Paul Allen runs. And they had a retrospective on old video games a while ago. And they had these sort of installations that were in a museum. You know, it was wow, it was really, really majestic looking. You know, but watching the kids all gathered around Monkey Island or Mario, you know, for that matter, and they were having a great time. They were lined up, you know, and really eager to play. And I know it sometimes catches people off guard because there is a little bit of that sentimentality, makes you think something sometimes wasn't, you know, was different than it was. And then you move on, you get more skilled, or you get used to other kinds of inputs or games, and you go back to those. And sometimes it feels great, sometimes not. But I still think it's really, especially as a game designer, it's really instructive to be able to go back and experience things kind of like in their natural form as they once were, if you can.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And it was one of the things that I was so loved when we heard that Good Old Games came into existence. I think it's been like 5 or 6 years at this point. I've lost all semblance of time doing this. But like when I heard that they were going to do this and they were going to bring back all these classic PC games, it was like, oh my goodness, this is actually going to happen? And it's been like one of my dreams to see something like that happen on the console market. But I know that is just, you know, a Pandora's box waiting to open of litigation and copyright.
Yeah, and a lot of consoles, especially the owner, I mean, it's a, you know, if they call it a walled garden, you know, and those walls still exist. So that also makes it a little more difficult to feel like there's a something quite as universal as Good Old Games is for PC games, because you know the PC being more of an open platform in the past made that that whole formula a little different for them.
Mm-hmm. And when I spoke to them, they also talked about having similar problems when it came to unique games. Like, I think they said that anything older than, I think, one of the windows was like almost like impossible for them to recreate or digitize today. Like, they're talking about like the DOS era, which for the console fans listening to this right now, you should be thankful that you've never had to deal with trying to run a game on DOS on a console.
Yeah. Break open the command line and
Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's definitely a topic that I hope that we see more conversations going forward about. Especially, I think one thing that was very interesting is just how much of the popularity of the NES Classic Edition that became the, you know, the very big holiday item, which Nintendo has decided to discontinue. But there are, of course, rumors circulating that we may see a SNES Classic Edition and stuff along those lines. So there's definitely interest in retro games and, again, preserving them. But I'm still not sure if it's at the, if like the mainstream is interested in that or not.
Yeah, it's hard to say. You know, it's the sort of thing where it might take just the right formula. I think Nintendo did a lot of, you know, smart things with that, because they made it really cool. They really made it sentimental, because you know it had the form factor that people remember, and you know it's got some it just hit the right sort of touchstones, you know, that to get people all excited. And I think that's also easy. It's also easy to use, you know, whereas, you know, I don't have to download an emulator and I don't have to set up, you know, a big arcade board or something like that to be able to, you know, do wacky different inputs. But I do think it'll be that the audience or the real purists who do kind of like break that ground that do make it easier for like the Nintendos to come along and do something like that. So it's, I don't know, sort of, it seems like it's sort of a process, you know, where we just keep kind of running up that hill. And then I think what will happen is, you know, it'll happen at some point, but it's also on some level, just probably always going to be sort of something that's like a subculture, but you know, an incredibly vibrant one.
Yeah, definitely. Now, speaking about hardware, I guess one somewhat of a tangent I want to ask you about, Clayton, especially since you work at Microsoft at the moment, is the what we've been seeing in terms of hardware coming out of Sony and Microsoft. As for those of you listening to this cast, I'm talking about what we've been seeing in terms of this idea of system upgrades with the PlayStation 4 Pro and the Xbox Scorpio. And this is definitely a very weird position in terms of console upgrades and console history. Obviously, as you're aware of, when we think of console life cycles, we of course think of each console basically starting off back at zero. Go from the NES to the SNES, N64, and so on. Mm-hmm. But what Sony and Microsoft are trying to do is essentially prolong this platform cycle. And as someone who's been in the industry for so long, and, you know, seeing this kind of evolution, what do you think about the strategy that they're both planning?
Yeah, I can't get, like, too deep into it for partly obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But I mean, just speaking as a consumer, just on my own, I can see some sense to it. And mm-hmm. going back to what you and I were just talking about, the idea that there's this continuity mm-hmm. on the platform that, yeah, I can do stuff that is awesome and new and state of the art, but it also lets me bring my game library along for the ride. Mm-hmm. is at least to me as a consumer, I like that notion a lot, because it means, again, there's that ability to fewer games are going to like just sort of fall off the back of the truck and never be seen again. I think if there's some effort to, you know, keep all that stuff moving forward with, you know, with generations of stuff that comes along. So I mean, that's how I kind of tend to view it, and that's just, again, that's just me. I can't really speak for, you know, the big strategist. That's kind of you know, above my pay grade. But
I don't want any suits to come in and like pull you off the mic talking about this.
if my key card doesn't work on the way back from lunch, although I said the wrong thing.
I guess from a design point of view, what do you think about the Nintendo Switch and how Nintendo is still trying to, I guess, be the odd man out when it comes to similar console cycles?
I think they've done some really clever things with it. I mean, it leverages kind of a lot of the strengths of the DS mm-hmm. Devices by having the portability. It still has the ability, though, to say, hey, I want to sit down and play something on my giant flat screen, and it works pretty well for that. I'm kind of a fan of the I like what they did, and I think they stated this even going back to the GameCube, is, you know, that they view themselves as like almost like a toy maker. You know, it should be toy-like. It should be something that's friendly and approachable and simple. Mm-hmm. And I think they've done a really nice job with that. I love playing my Switch.
Yeah. Hopefully I'll be able to grab one some point this year, but it's definitely interesting getting to see how this console cycle is really shaping up with the Switch and the upgrades for the PS4 and Xbox One. And some, this is one of those cases where I don't think we'll know right now just what will be the potential impact of this going forward.
Yeah, it's going to be an exciting time, I think. I mean, just speaking as someone who's worked on a lot of games and a lot of different platforms over the years, I like an industry where everyone's successful.
Yeah, me too.
I like a healthy game industry for some reason.
Yeah, who knew? Who would bunk it?
Yeah, so, you know, it's the sort of thing where obviously I'll have my own partisan leanings because of the work I do, but I'm also like really always intrigued by what other people are doing and, you know, building and playing, and you know, again, the people I work with, the designers especially, we, you know, we play everything, we look at everything, we like everything. So mm-hmm. To me, that just gives me more cool stuff to do.
Oh yeah, definitely. And it certainly keeps me busy around here with a backlog of games. At this point, I've resigned myself that I will never be able to play through all of them. It's just, unless we get cloning at some point in like the next 2-3 years, I will not be able to get through all these games.
Not enough hours in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I know that, like, especially the year or so, especially when I'm working on the Voodoo Vince port, you know, during my evenings and weekends, I felt like I got way behind on my stuff. You know, I think a few of us call it, you know, the Tower of Shame, the stuff. There's the stuff I've taken out of the package and maybe I've booted it up. There's the stuff that's still shrink wrapped. There's download games I haven't even, you know, booted up yet. So I feel like I keep acquiring the games, but I don't have time to play them as much as I want. So it's a sad, sad, sad time. So
I know. And then there are cases where I bought games and I realize I already bought them or I already have them on Steam.
Oh, yeah.
That's always the best
part. I've done that more than once.
I know. That's when you know that there's an issue, when you just have games that you don't even remember buying and they're just, you know, on your Steam list. And it's like, when the heck did that happen? And it's like you're looking at the day and you're trying to solve the mystery of what happened on that day that I bought this?
It's tough. I probably need to start a journal or something. I'm sure there must gotta be software for that somewhere. Yeah. Some kind of way to organize your time. I don't know. Crazy idea.
I guess moving on to another topic, I wanted to just talk to you about for a few minutes. Regarding your work with Total Annihilation and Chris Taylor, because it's always interesting, again, like when I speak to developers, especially those who have been around long in the industry, again, about like, you know, like that 6 degrees of separation of some of the games they've worked on that I didn't even think about. For instance, I recently spoke with designer Sandy Peterson. Do you know him?
No.
He's a board game designer who also worked at Ensemble Studios on the Age of Empires series.
Oh.
So, like, I was, like, talking to him, goes, wait a minute, you worked on Age of Empires? And it's always fun to, like, see, like, again, because one of the weird things about this industry is that the path that your career can take in terms of what games you worked on and where you go.
So,
I guess, and I think I actually emailed Chris Taylor like a few years ago. I think this was when he was doing the Kickstarter for his RTS. Unfortunately, didn't make it because I would love to talk to him about RTSs. I know, obviously, with your work on Total Annihilation at Cave Dog, that you're definitely a fan of RTS games as well.
Sure, absolutely.
Man, so I guess, and that's another, like, speaking about, like, genres which have, you know, dipped and waned over the years, the RTS genre has definitely fit that case, especially when it comes to, again, like, the old style of macro-heavy RTS games. I'm thinking Command & Conquer, Age of Empires, and even Total Annihilation. And I guess my question for you, Clayton, is, when it comes to the RTS genre, like, seeing how it's grown and changed, like, what do you think of, like, I guess, the current market compared to, again, when we were growing up or playing them in the 90s?
Yeah, you know, it's funny how I think I worked in or on RTS games for, yeah, a few years, and then I went back to work with Chris at, at Gas Powered right around the time Supreme Commander came out. And, yeah, you know, I don't know if I've been following the trends as closely as I should, you know, like in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years, I haven't been really that involved in, in that genre. It's been an interesting mix of things because I think it's hard to find, especially a PC gamer audience that is, you know, it's like they're the most committed, the most technically knowledgeable, the most, you know, just, man, just play on a certain very deep, like involving the very molecules of their being. RTS gamers. I mean, they have a certain, there's something very distinctive, I think, about that audience and about those games. Yes. And it seems to call to a certain mindset. And I guess as far as like what they were and what they are now is an interesting question to me. I look back on, let's go to side scrollers. Okay. Let's talk about, you know, the reason I think a lot of those games are so popular was, well, there was technology that handled them super well. I mean, the stuff that, you know, the hardware for like the SNES, the Sega Genesis, it was really designed to be able to just throw a lot of tiles at the screen and make them scroll by really fast. And there was that magic though of like, hey, look, I'm pushing a button and moving these crosshairs on the D-pad and hey, the guy's moving. And there's, you know, there's that magic, right? It's funny how when you haven't seen that before in your life, it's magic, you know, and there's that charm of just like just jumping and running along and just that kind of the joy of that could define a whole genre for years and years and years and spawn hundreds and hundreds of games. And I feel like there's a process like that with RTS to some extent. I think when, you know, in the wake of especially Doom, and the ones that kind of led to Command and Conquer and Warcraft 2, the idea that the little characters on the screen and you click on them and they say something funny and then they'll go do the thing you tell them to do. And then there's a bunch of them and then you get to see, you know, the sort of scope, this scale of things that I don't think we'd seen on a screen before in games. I mean, I think strategy games have always been with us, but the idea that graphically it was delivering this super, really interesting, super intense thing that was really engaging. You know, I don't know. I feel like that was part of what got the foot in the door, you know, for RTS being popular and where, you know, Westwood and, you know, those guys were smart was like, you could run Command and Conquer on like an old 486. So it ran great on hand-me-downs, right? You know, but there's this thing we do, right? When we build games and we start iterating on them and we start doing new generations, we start making them more and more complex. We make them more graphically interesting, more, you know, and more demanding in every sense, the, you know, the stuff you have to do for better AI. And I think RTS is more intense about that than almost any other kind of game. I think the idea is going to render a whole planet now.
Oh, and yes.
You're going to have, you know, things that have really good formations and AI, and they're interacting intelligently with each other. You're micromanaging, but not too much. You know, there's that balance of the gameplay versus the decision making and how you're managing your clicks per minute. And I guess what I feel like sometimes RTS, I wouldn't say it painted itself into a corner, but it is to a point where it is really this. It's not the 486, the hand me down with a giant audience anymore. It's got to be a pretty badass computer to handle, I think, what the very best things that are being done in the genre right now. It's kind of ironic that I see games that are exactly like Total Annihilation on the iPad.
I know.
they're doing a lot of the things we did because in a way, that's why Total Annihilation was never as big a hit as those other games. At the time, the system requirements were really steep for the game. Even it's hard to believe it now when you look at it and play it on GOG. But I'm kind of rambling around here, I guess. But I think what this has led to also are games that I think back in the day we would have considered more tactical. More action, more tactical, less commanding vast armies. I mean, yes, those games obviously exist, and they're still in a really enthusiastic audience. But kind of like what we were saying for platformers, it becomes this intense, super, super energetic subculture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, definitely, especially when it came to, again, like that divide in terms of RTS designs. Like, obviously, we can talk about on one end of the scale stuff like Total Annihilation, Supreme Commander, even something like Planetary Annihilation that came out a few years ago. And then you have on the other end, you have, again, these very tactical or micro layer games like Company of Heroes, Dawn of War, and so on. It's really created an interesting divide to look at how these designs work. I was talking to a friend about this in terms of time. It will probably be like a few weeks for those of you listening. We were talking about the state of esports when it comes to these kinds of real-time strategy games. And as you said, there's always that balance between like designing this game in terms of like quality of life and what kind of features you want, and then appealing to the hardcore community, the people who play games like StarCraft at like, you know, several hundred clicks per minute kind of thing. Like, and I have resigned myself that I will never be a pro StarCraft player. I just don't have it in me to move that quickly while trying to play a game like that.
Yeah, that's a real commitment, and it's super awesome and rewarding, I think, for the people who do. But yeah, it's for anyone who doesn't have the time, like we were also talking about earlier, that's off-putting. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't mean in a way that's like negative, but more like, I can't do that.
Yeah.
It is not realistic for me. And although it's funny how you mentioning that, we were never as good at our own game as any number of people on Earth were within 5 minutes of the game coming out. So it's that's another thing you have to get used to when you work on any kind of game.
Whenever a new game is released, you know within probably like 24, 40 hours, someone will break that game. Doesn't matter what the game is, doesn't matter when it comes out, there's always going to be someone who will immediately figure it out and just utterly wreck it. I was reading stories about this at the time of this recording, that someone's already like mastered the new game Prey. Like they'd be in like 30, 40 minutes or something like that. Yeah, wow. I know, it's crazy. And especially when it comes to the competitive scene. Like, you know, with any kind of competitive game, be it StarCraft, Counter-Strike, League of Legends, whatever, that there's always people who have just wrecked that game. They know exactly how to play it. And it's always that's one of those strange things. And I guess this is the final tangent before we go to platformer, is one of the biggest changes when it came to game development and just design philosophy over the last decade would be this idea of quote unquote games as a service. When it's not just about making a game, releasing it, and then moving on to the next game. It's you make the game, you release it, and now you're still supporting it for 6 months to a year, and in some cases even longer than that, to keep this game growing. Yeah. So I guess, again, as a long-time developer, what do you think about that kind of change in philosophy, Clayton?
You know, it's not surprising, mm-hmm. right? Every form of entertainment is fighting for every split second of eyeball attention mm-hmm. that they can get. And it's not so much that, again, back when everything was like controlled and you know, in the sense of like, oh, the retail channels and all that stuff were all set up and very, very organized. And the games came out at a certain cadence and they were promoted a certain way. You know, it was like there was a certain everything just seemed completely, in favor of like that kind of old school mm-hmm. way of just developing, publishing, you know. And it's interesting, right? Because the time you have for your game to come out and make a splash and get people mm-hmm. excited is very different. It's just, it's all compressed yeah. now. It's all short. And part of that is just the way economics have changed. Part of that's just, the way there's so much content now. There's so much out there mm-hmm. Competing for your time and attention now. You know, there's this thing called the internet, I hear.
Yes.
But as far as that happening, I'm not too surprised or put off, because it's in a weird way, and maybe we didn't intend it, but Total Annihilation, you know, we had the weekly download unit, you know, after the game came out for a good long time. And we accidentally left some stuff in our header files. Like, oh, I think we left the header files in by mistake. And that opened the door for all kinds of mods and stuff, which, you know, we didn't suspect it at the time. We didn't know it was going to happen. But it greatly, greatly extended the life of that title. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think at one point you get that report that, you know, how many web hits you had every week. And I remember seeing some of those reports where, oh, yeah, we're in the top 100 websites in the world. And, you know, at the time we didn't think much of it because it was all kind of new, you know. But, oh, that's neat, you know. And now I'm realizing top 100 in the world is insane. And I mean, there were weeks where we had, I think at its peak, I think we had over 10 million uniques in like one week. And this is the mid 90s, which also tells you a lot of people were pirating our game. but the point being, in a way, Total Annihilation was a service. You know, we just didn't know it, you know, because we thought, oh, we'll keep adding to it. And, oh, we'll keep having these download units. Oh, people like them. Hey, it's keeping our sales alive. And that's really interesting. It's funny how we probably didn't view it, though, through that lens. You know, we didn't think of it as a service. We just thought of it as, well, I guess this will help us keep selling our game. And So I guess there's a really roundabout way of saying it feels really familiar, mm-hmm. this games as a service philosophy, but I believe it's being done to combat and to compete in ways that just, you know, didn't exist in the 90s. Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think, something we're going to only see grow bigger as we're going forward in the end of this decade, especially with, again, the big name publishers like Ubisoft, for instance. They have been certainly embracing games as a service with Rainbow Six Siege, The Division, mm-hmm. and even what we're seeing with what they're playing with the new Destiny game. Or that's a different studio, obviously. But, like, as you were saying, it's definitely been in the DNA, especially on the PC side, to keep supporting your game, be it through weekly updates or patches and expansions. But we're seeing it more, I guess, commoditize in a sense, especially on the console side.
Yeah.
I guess one quick question for you, Clayton. Going back to what you're saying in terms of the shorter time period in order for a game to make a splash, I guess just from my own education, I've always been thinking it's been about like 30 to 60 days from a game being released, you know, for the bulk of its sales. Is that still true, or has it been even cut shorter than that?
This is just my own gut reaction, but yeah, I think you were right. Historically, that is correct. I think that the rule of thumb I always heard over the years, like, you know, 6 weeks, you know, you kind of have a 6 week window. So yeah, it's right in with what you're saying. It feels like it feels like it's maybe half that now. It really feels that way to me. I mean, I'm only basing that on my own, like, feeling of, oh, I didn't get around to playing that game that was out a month ago. And it's just funny how it feels like it's just, you know, almost forgotten by then. Mm-hmm.
And again, that's another topic we could spend a whole lot of time on.
Oh my gosh, I know.
We are about 40 minutes into this recording. We still haven't even gotten to talking about platformers yet. So we better switch to that before this will be like a 2-3 hour cast. So let's move on. And again, if you're up to it, we can always have you back on either for a recording or even a live discussion at some point. Because one of the things that I found is that this industry is just rich with topics that we can spend who knows how many hours discussing if, you know, our voices can hold up by the end of it.
Yeah, yeah, especially in allergy season here. We'll be croaking here
exactly.
For a while.
So we'll move on. For those of you listening to the cast right now, we'll probably move on to our final topic, hopefully. We'll see where things take us. And discuss more about platformer design, because this is a very interesting topic. The reason being is, I'm sure everyone here listening knows that platformers have been around for a very long time. You mentioned, I guess, earlier in the cast, Clay, and about, again, the joy of the original Mario. And that's probably a good hour and a half topic alone on that. But platformer, it's one of those genres that, from the outside, it looks very easy in terms of its design because so many people have made games about it. And we could spend a good maybe 20, 30 minutes just like listing platformers we've played, and we probably won't hit all of them. But when it comes to designing them, that kind of, I guess, blank canvas really makes it a challenge in terms of building them. Because there is a very, I guess there's, it feels like there's a very wide margin between what's considered an amazing platformer, like your Marios, your Crash Bandicoots, and the like, versus the ones that have fallen out of favor, such as everyone's favorite game, Bubsy the Cat, from the mid-90s.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. I guess my first question for you, Clayton, and again, like, there's so many different so many different ways to start this conversation. I guess the first one is, when you think of good and bad platforming design, I guess, are there any things that immediately stick out to you?
Oh, wow. Wow. That's a,
I know.
It's a huge topic.
There's no easy way to like jump into this one.
it's interesting because I'll base some of this on just my own lessons from building one. Certainly if I were building Vince today, I would make it very differently in many ways than what I did then. But that's hindsight. You know, that's that experience talking. I guess to me, there's like things you can do right and things you can do wrong. And it's like a lot of those are the decisions that you make in the very formative stage of when you're first like setting out to make the game and design the game. I think any kind of game, it doesn't matter the genre. If you're backing in too much stuff late, you're not really doing it right, or you're at least you're kind of in the sort of defensive reactionary mode that usually leads to less good creative choices. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like if you've got what I've always considered like the DNA kind of dialed in, you know what you want to make, you know the tone of it, you know the focus of the character, who is the character, what are they like? And I think, you know, like I'm not going to put Vince on the same, you know echelon as like as Mario at all, but I think we did have that. We understood the world, the setting, and it just kind of jumped right off the page from the very first, you know, sketches and pieces of concept art. So that helped everyone focus. That helped the artist figure out a look. That helped us kind of figure out puzzles and things that could leverage those things about that character. And I think starting with that little nugget of something, you know, that makes your game stand out, however small, is the thing that really leads to certainly the better experiences, the better games in a genre.
Yeah, but
you know, that it would be, I'd say, in opposition to saying I'm just going to do like a carbon copy of something, throw together some stuff. And you know, the platformer genre in particular is just ravenous for content. Mm-hmm. It just eats up content. I mean, you get a lot of hours out of a fairly small arena or something like that, depending on the kind of game you're building for, you know, like multiplayer matches and things like that. And I'd say the amount of story, the amount of environments, the change of those environments to keep them fresh so you don't get too tired of looking at the same stuff. The list just goes on. And even a fairly simple, what you would consider maybe a medium and kind of platform, there's a ton of content in there. Mm-hmm. And that's not easy to make. And then beyond that, it's funny, if you do have that foundation and you do have those things I described, it's the backstretch. It's the thousand little tiny bits of polish. Mm. It's that person. It's the personality. It's those things that tell the player that your game was loved. Mm-hmm. You know, that the team that made it was committed to it. And man, gamers can, I mean, again, doesn't matter the genre. This is not specific to platformers. I think if players see what they consider a cynical play, you know, or something that wasn't done with integrity, they can smell it a mile away.
Yes. And I made a video about this, again, by the time people were listening just a few weeks ago, regarding gamepad layouts or designing your control scheme for a game. And I said in that, if you do it right, no one will ever notice it because they're too busy playing it. But you make one mistake or your control scheme has any problems with it, and everybody will figure that out and call you out on it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so true. And that's true of so many systems that reside within your game. The big win is nobody
exactly. And getting back to what you were just saying, Clay, regarding getting the foundation right in a platformer, that's again one of those very interesting aspects. Because when we look at, you can pick like just about any genre, first person shooter, strategy games that we were talking about, RPGs, they all have like, you know, a very basic gameplay loop. Like the same thing, you know, as you said, it's the DNA that makes these genres. And then from there, they can grow in wildly different directions. Like with platformers, for instance, when we think of a platformer, we can talk about, again, a Mario game. But we could also talk about something like Metroid or even Metroidvanias. Absolutely. When, oh my goodness, if we start talking about Metroidvanias, we'll be here for probably another 3 hours easily. But
yeah, yeah. And I think it's been the foundation of a lot of different games that, you know, again, come out of different new, fresh iterations every few years. But yeah, yeah, that's right.
And I guess with that kind of foundation, again, it goes back to the challenge of designing a platformer, is that when we say platformer, it's kind of like designing a car. Like, you know what goes in, you know the basics of a car. It has to drive, it has to have turn signals, stuff like that. But then trying to make it stand out, make it something different, is when we run into those problems. And as I'm sure you're no doubt aware of, Clay, in that when it comes to like creating something like a platformer, like how do you make your platformer stand out from, again, the dozens or if not hundreds of other games? And as a interest or as another case in point of this, that's kind of like how the rise of the quote-unquote mascot platformer genre really took hold in the mid-90s, early 2000s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. And I think everyone was always looking for that vehicle. You know, I think it was also generally thought at the time that especially consoles were, you know, family devices. They're, you know, they're very broad appeal, very mainstream sorts of things. And I think for a long time they were, and they still are, obviously, to some extent. I think, though, that the audience itself also continued to grow and mature as well. So, you know, I've said this, I think, several times before, but, there was this idea that, hey, is the mascot of this new Xbox going to be one of these platformers that were in development at the time? There were actually a few, including Vince.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what I think nobody suspected was that, yeah, there would be a mascot for Xbox, but it would be a Master Chief. It wouldn't be a voodoo doll or any other kind of cuddly character or anything like that at all. And that's okay. And, you know, that's what players decided. Yeah. That is what the audience decided. And that's, you know, I have no problem with that at all. I think that makes perfect sense.
Now,
I'm not sure if that answers any of your questions, but
I think it did a little bit in terms of, again, like this kind of like evolution of, and as we were saying earlier in the cast, how the audience and how designing games has certainly shifted from, again, the 80s and the 90s to the 2000s and where we are today. And there's two parts of platforming design that I definitely want to touch on, because, again, this is such a very rich genre in terms of examining. And the first one is the difficulty. This is one of those aspects that really stands out in terms of the different kinds of designs you can put into them. One of the, I think, the biggest things, or one of the best games I've seen recently, would probably be something like Super Mario Maker. and being able to sit down and actually try and design levels yourself. And the degree or the wide spectrum of difficulty in that is just fascinating to examine as someone who's interested in design. And the platformer genre, as I'm sure you're not aware of, is a very player skill or player influence genre. There's, unless we're talking about something with like a Metroidvania, it's up to the player to do these crazy maneuvers and get around the platforms like that. And because of that, there is such a wide degree in terms of difficulty. I mean, I've played platformers designed for like 4 or 5 year olds, you know, very simplistic platforms. And then on the other end, we have games like Super Meat Boy, where it's just a gauntlet of death in terms of trying to get through them.
Explosion.
So my question for you is, in terms of difficulty, how do you define that balance? Like, how do you make a platformer that is inviting, or how do you go about making something that could be played by multiple skill levels? And again, like, this is a topic that there's so many different questions we can put into it.
Yeah, it really is. I think we've made that more of a focus in the earlier third, maybe half of Voodoo Vince. And this is more traditional in older platforms as well, to say, okay, if you're with us to the end, and then as now, you're only looking at maybe 10%.
It's time for the glove to come off, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And at the time, too, it was considered perfectly acceptable to have a 4-stage boss battle beyond a point of no return. So we were like, okay, well, we'll do that. But the earlier levels, certainly, yeah, it's an interesting question. I think part of it is if you can, if possible, provide alternate routes, provide multiple ways to get to things. If you want the extra goodie, but maybe it takes you a little extra platforming to get to it, that's okay. But and this is one thing the 3D platformer especially opened up, was the ability to say, yeah, you can run around on the ground, or you can find the way up to the rooftops, and you can run along there, or the balconies, or things like that. You can do three different routes through a level that help, you know, one that rewards mastery, one that's accessible and fairly easy to cross. We didn't always succeed at that in Vince, but we do in some of the earlier, especially the hub areas, we tried to make it that way. So, you know, you had at least some opportunities to, test your skills if you want to, but generally we wanted most people to be able to get through.
And like one, I always say, is one of my favorite examples of, again, providing those multiple avenues would be like the Mario Galaxy series. Just, again, being accommodating towards multiple skill levels, and then, of course, the final parts of the game just saying, okay, you want challenge? Here it is. You know, have fun with this
part. Yeah, or the side levels that are just crazy platforming challenges.
I guess, as a question for you, Clay, in terms of designing platformers, when we're talking about the opposite, and, you know, the hardcore, super challenging, my voice is starting to go out as I'm talking, like, do you think there is a line in terms of how hard to make a platformer? And as a good case in point of that, one of the things that we've seen out of the indie and enthusiast side of things has been the rise of these uber platforming challenges. Stuff like, I don't know if you heard of something like I Want to Be the Guy, or what we've been seeing in Mario Maker, I think it's like Kaizu or Kaizo challenges, where it's just like these are levels that require pixel perfect mastery of everything, or you will never beat them kind of challenges.
Yeah, and to me that harkens back to the old days. I mean, that's exactly what we did. Every platformer used to be that.
Yeah.
So, and the reason, part of the reason for that was it helped us get a lot of hours of gameplay out of very little content. As we've said, there's the content itself is challenging and can be expensive to make. And certainly back in the old days when we had 1,024 tiles to build everything in like a Super Nintendo game, we, you know, had to be very stingy and sometimes just complete jerks about difficulty on a lot of those. And those are one hit deaths too. I mean, I don't know if you remember that, but like Mario, you get hit and you're done, you know, and maybe you can take a second hit. Maybe you get an extra little power up or something, but, So difficulty was kind of like the watchword of the day. That's what it was, you know, and when I think a lot of that. And then it's only in the last, I think, 20 years maybe that the idea of like, having a health bar and having to be able to rack up extra mm-hmm. things and stockpile lives if you have a life system at all, which even that's been, you know, fallen by the wayside for a lot of game designs mm-hmm. now. You know, it's not like but you don't run out of lives. It's just and, you know, part of that also goes back to the idea of retention. Keeping people in your game, you know, I was like, well, if you keep killing them, maybe they won't come back. So, you know, there's, I think a lot of things have driven that philosophy, but a lot of it is just to make it, you know, we have bigger teams now, we can make more content. If you really want people to get into your world and enjoy them, you probably have to be a little less onerous mm-hmm. than we were then, you know, all those years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, again, that's kind of what we've been talking about over this cast with the evolution or the growth in terms of game design philosophy, especially over the last decade, when we really saw a push towards making games more accessible, more streamlined. Suddenly, it wasn't just, hey, everyone design a completely different control scheme for our games. It's, people know that X is the jump button. Or A if you're using an Xbox controller, well, then let's just everyone use A as the jump button. And it's like little things like that started to make it easier to get into these games. And suddenly we saw you don't need like 80-page manuals anymore for your video games.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. We're all more skilled. Mm-hmm. There are these, methods that are becoming, that are more standard so people understand or expect. Mm-hmm. Work a certain way. And I think that's actually been, it's been really interesting. I think it's been mostly a positive thing. I was just thinking as you were describing it though, there's something also about that. Thinking about, actually back to Vince and difficulty, because I was trying to like circle back to your original question around some of that. It was relatively new. I mean, and I'm sure it had existed for some time before that, but the idea of doing not just usability, user testing, things like that when we were making mm-hmm. the game. But I was just thinking back to how my studio worked with our test leads mm-hmm. at Microsoft to develop testing tools. Yeah. And in fact, there was this thing called the Vince API, which got used on a huge percentage of Xbox 360 games in the next generation after that. And those are things like generating heat maps, things mm-hmm. like that, to show where all your players are dying. So, and we started working with that kind of data, mm-hmm. even in a very rudimentary way on Vince to sort of like say, okay, this jump is totally not fair. Oh, everyone's dying here. And you know, occasionally if it's a challenging area, that's okay. Mm-hmm. But at what point is it too much? And then lining that up with, you know, surveys, feedbacks, things like that. And I think we tried to strike a balance between those things. And I think you're right though. I think in the last 10 years, I was, it's been the kind of eye opener for me going back to Vince after mm-hmm. 13 years. I haven't seen it, in a long time. I've really gone in there and looked at a lot of stuff really closely. And, you know, the notion that there's no map, mm-hmm.
yeah,
you would get a map today. You would mm-hmm. absolutely be shown where things are. And, oh, it's over there to the left. Oh, there's the things I'm looking for. They're blinking. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's good in some cases. If the challenge is, hey, we just want the running and jumping to be the challenge, then maybe the challenge isn't where the thing is, but getting to the thing. So okay, some of that's okay. But, I mean, there is sort of that risk that you could be, you know, also making the game less engaging. It's going to be, you know, people are not going to feel satisfied if they don't feel like they've, you know, had a chance to apply some actual mm-hmm. skill.
And we've seen, like, for instance, I've been trying in the past to get into, like, the Traveler's Tales, like, their whole Lego series. And, mm-hmm. like, I just found them just to be, again, like, they're aimed for more of the younger audience, but I just found them to be just way too simplistic for me. Like, it just felt like I was being handheld the entire time. But I remember the days, again, like, in the 80s and 90s when games aimed at kids were stuff like Contra and, I'm trying to think of some like the more extreme examples of platformers. Little Nemo the Dream Master, or the Capcom era of 2D platformers during the late 80s, early 90s, when it wasn't, kids didn't mean that they held back. They just made it brutally difficult for you back then.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's one topic. Again, we could spend probably an hour on this one alone, but it definitely needs to be mentioned, especially when we talk about the evolution of platforming design. And you brought this up a little bit a few minutes ago, but it's, of course, the camera. One of the major evolutions of platformer design, especially that jump from 2D to 3D that happened in the mid-90s, is, of course, the 3D camera. And as I'm sure you're no doubt aware of with this one, that a good camera can make or break a game in some cases. And it's just one of those things, again, that if you're not actively thinking about it, it's not one of those topics that you spend too much time on. But when it comes to designing your game, especially something that is player emphasis, like a platformer, there must be there has to be a lot of work that goes into designing a camera that can work with your game.
Yeah, it's continuous too. I mean, almost till the day you ship, I think you have to be able to adjust and tune and tweak, and certainly it's the one thing from a 13-year-old platformer that I hear the most about, and that is reasonable to hear about that. It's the sort of thing where, as a 4-person team, you know, I would have probably, if I could have, I would have gone in and maybe looked at that. But we were doing a restoration, not a redesign of the game. So for good or ill. We decided to be faithful to the original, but that's my own little, hey, sorry guys. but the point you make though is actually very correct, because, again, talking about those ingredients of a good platformer, not only does it make or break your game, but you need to think of the camera as being, you know, absolutely integrated with your character. There is like no separation between those two things. It's not just this thing that floats outside your character. It's the thing that, shows you where you're going. It's the thing that helps you notice things. It's the thing that, you know, keeps you oriented on the world in a way that doesn't make you sick, if you can avoid that. And this has been one of the, you know, interesting things with the remaster on Voodoo Vents is, everything was tuned for TVs, smaller TVs, and further from you. Now that people are often playing on a PC and they're very close to the game physically, that's the thing where the amount of field of view and things like that starts to feel maybe not as good as it should. That's some feedback we had from Steam. Somebody already broke open a hex editor and made a field of view adjustment like a tool for the game. And we're actually working right now on adding that functionality to our options for the game. But kind of back to your point, yeah, it's a thing where you hope nobody notices your camera, and that is the best camera on earth. And every other camera, it's like, oh, you know. And so I'd say for 2003, I think we actually had a pretty decent camera. I mean, it has, and there's an intense list of properties on a camera, you know, just the, not just the distance and the field of view, but how it averages movement over bumpy terrain, how it negotiates around corners, how it tries to keep the character in its view, and how it tries to show you where you ought to go. Beyond that, all kinds of scripts and subscripts that run inside of your levels. You know, are you going to alter things in a tunnel versus another type of situation? We will sometimes lock the direction of the camera, like specifically because we want to try to sort of like do some side scroller style gameplay, or there's a boss we want you to focused on, and it goes on and on. And it's just, yeah, it never ends. It's as much work as the character itself.
And one of the things, like from my own experience, that has always, I think, signify the difference between a good and bad camera is how well it shows the depth of the world, or that kind of depth perception when it comes to jumping. Because one of the things that has just killed some platformers for me is when I have no ability to see, or basically to judge the distance of platformers. And I've played a few of those over the years where it just becomes a guessing game of where am I in relation to this platform and how am I supposed to get over to it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I think every platform has some of that frustration somewhere in it. But the really good ones minimize that as much as possible. I think I was describing that the other day as like a mental calculus you have to do. Like, okay, I'm not really playing the game. I'm calculating where I might end up. I know that obviously Vince has its own issues in some levels with that. But at the same time, it's a thing that we did our best to minimize as much as we could.
Now, I guess here is a quick tangent question for you. As we've been talking about, again, older games and trying to go back to them, are there any aspects of, I'm talking about games from early thousands to the 90s, are there any aspects of these games that basically you just cannot go back to? Like, again, there are people who still play classic RPGs, you know, the old school late 80s pen and paper style ones, which I since I didn't grow up with them, I just can't go back to them. But and for you, like, are there any of those mechanics or, you know, the quote unquote the old ways of design that it's just too much of a leap back for you if you're trying to play these older games?
Wow, you know, I hadn't really thought in those terms, because I always feel like, you know, especially when you've been designing games for a while, the list of design ideas is like that sort of in the attic. it gets considerable, and even if there's something I would not tend to do, it's funny how it's often true though that what was old is new again. Sometimes an old solution can be exactly what you need, maybe. And so keeping that perspective, or at least keeping the door open, even if you know you wouldn't maybe if it wouldn't be your first instinct to use maybe something from an older game. I'm just trying to think if there's something that I just remember really, really being frustrated by, you know, or you know, and yeah, obviously there's a bunch of different things. I think, oh man, controller design is in general pretty good now. You know, I was thinking about some of the moments either on the N64 controller occasionally, that original Xbox controller, the Duke, remember that thing? You know, and, you know, the knife-like buttons that would make your fingers hurt. that's more like, you know, hardware design and things like that. I think in terms of actual game design, I think I remember there being some moments of just like when we were first coming to grips with using 3D at all in games. This is before I was even working on 3D games. I was still working on 2D games for the most part. But you'd play some of those very first generation, you know, games, and some of which I love, like Medieval. Yes. You know, and I love that. But I think if you went back and checked out that camera and that action and that frame rate, you'd probably feel like, I don't know. And again, the game itself, I don't think is at fault. I think it was the everything they could with the time and tools and technology they had. So it's funny, I'm turning this into a more like a when is the thing I'm sentimental about really not that good.
Yeah, the rose tinted glasses is always tricky. Like,
which is for me a double edged sword, given that I just remastered a 13-year-old game. Sorry, I guess I didn't really have a real concise answer on that. Like, I don't have a checklist of things.
Sorry. I hate. Like, for me, like, FMV-style games are one of, like, the hardest ones to go back to. I remember growing up playing, like, Dragons Space Ace.
Okay, yeah, that's – wow. Okay, well
– I may have just made it easy for you there.
you kind of did. That's a – well, that's an easy kind of – well, okay. But I love stories. I love stories in games. And I've worked with a lot of people over the years who are some of the best storytellers in games. And the temptation, obviously, of those, was to like, hey, I want to be able to, you know, play this really epic, cool story, but I want to be able to interact with it. And the promise at the time, I think everyone thought would be like, oh, this will be amazing. It'll be like playing a movie. It's like, well, no. Because the load times, every time something happened, or every time you moved into a different room or whatever, was always kind of tricky, you know. Seventh Guest did an interesting job of kind of like mixing classic adventure game with some, you know, more rendered clips of things, and yet it didn't really, you know, it didn't really slow down the game a whole lot. Kind of interesting. Yeah, I'm trying to remember some of those ones that came out in those early, early CD-ROM games, and just sitting and waiting for crap to load was painful. And I'm charging up on something here. I actually have a point. Is that I think the promise of that and the ambition of that is still with us, but now that games in general can load up a lot more stuff and stream things a lot better, you know, we are getting those moments that are truly cinematic.
Definitely.
So I think the ambition and the dream was fantastic. I think we're just in a better position now to deliver that. So I guess so. Back to what I was saying, I think the idea was good, but now we can actually make it really, really awesome.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned Medieval a few minutes ago, because I was thinking about that game as we've been talking, in terms of, again, like the purity of just, you know, the mascot platformer, you know, the age of that. And talking about those older, those first generation ones, here's one. I'm not sure if you've ever played one of Hervit, but I remember there was a platformer for the PlayStation 1 about playing as the Jersey Devil, or it was like something like that. You're playing as like a little devil character.
Oh, yeah, I think, you know, it sounds familiar. I don't think I ever played that.
And that's like the thing. Like, there's so many of those platformers coming out. And, like, I remember, like, Toomba, which was one of my favorites. But, it's such a, again, we could spend, who knows, how many more hours talking about platformers and design and whatnot. But I know we are approaching about an hour and 15, and I'm sure you have to get going in a few minutes. So, there is one topic, I guess, this will be my final question, then we'll see where things take us, I guess. But, as we've been talking about, especially over this cast, with, again, looking at new versus old, or even in some cases, taking old mechanics and bringing them back today. As we've been saying, the platformer or the mascot platformer genre has certainly declined over the last few years. And one of the things that we've really been seeing, especially with Kickstarter and crowdfunding, again, has been developers having a chance to, you know, dip back into that pool to bring back those genres of games that the major publishers just aren't supporting anymore. But with that said, and as we've said, especially in our first part with, you know, retro games and trying to preserve them, that there's always that fine line between looking back at an older idea and, you know, trying to do something new with it versus, again, a straight one-for-one, we're going to make a game exactly like we did in 1997 kind of deal. And a big example of this over the last few months would be something like Yooka-Laylee, which was, of course, for those of you who don't know, was essentially a modern take on the platformer mascot genre, specifically the Banjo-Kazooie series. It was made by X-Rare developers. And I've heard very interesting reports from that game. At this moment in time, I haven't had a chance to play it, sadly, but I do, that there are people who complain that about a lot of the elements of Yooka-Laylee, which were indicative of those older games, and how some people wanted essentially a, not so much a, you know, ground top to bottom restoration, but taking this going forward. And my question is, when we're thinking about games like this, especially with trying to go back to these older designs, do you think that there is still a market for, again, straight up one-to-one, we're making a 1992 platformer versus saying, we're going to take this design and we're going to go forward in a different direction? And a perfect case, a perfect example of this would be the work of Shovel Knight by Yacht Club Games, who looked at 2D design of the late 80s, early 90s and said, we're going to start at this point, but we're going to go in a completely different direction.
Right, right. Well, I mean, fortunately, we're in a world where both can exist, and it doesn't. And I don't think it has to be either. Whether there is there a market for it, it's it's interesting because the my earlier point that many of these games are beloved but not popular. I know that sounds really brutal coming from someone who absolutely would love to do nothing but character platformers, but that's, you know, often looking at this, how things do when they go out there. And, you know, and yeah, you're right. Kickstarter is a great sort of way for those games to just find the people who love them and make them for the people who love them. And I think you can absolutely make a business out of that. I don't think there's, I mean, just looking at how well their Kickstarter did and the nice quality of what they were able to produce, I feel like, oh, that's super encouraging. I mean, I think that's really, really cool. But yeah, I mean, I think ideas are going to constantly move forward. I mean, we're all, you know, designers are odd collectors mentally. You know, we're magpies. We've, whatever that shiny thing is that we got to do or find or we're drawn to, you know, we will, and we will take, you know, whatever the sum of our previous experiences are, and we'll roll them into some crazy new, utter, you know, just different twist on that. And at least that's to me how the process works when you're doing this right. So I guess what I'm saying is, yeah, I mean, if the games that are just an absolute callback to how they used to be can find an audience and be made, I think that is all super good. And yet there will be obviously always room for innovation. I think every genre is always waiting to get reinvented for sure. I was just trying to think back on other genre, you know, that have been written off. Mm-hmm. there was a time, believe it or not, when RPGs were just considered the kiss of death in PC games.
The survival horror genre too has seen that peaks and valleys too.
And a couple of things happen. Sometimes those ideas do live on, but they get folded in. Like I said, we're just these incredible, you know, just man, we'll just grab things, use things, and you know, we're shameless in how we borrow and add things to games from previous games. And yeah, the platformer genre isn't what it was in terms of the types of games and the types of audience. But if you look at any number of games, you will see the platformer genre still mm-hmm. in there. I mean, if you play Uncharted, I mean, obviously from Naughty Dog. So, I mean, mm-hmm. hey, you know, that is their DNA. That is their pedigree. And there are any number of examples of that where, oh, really, if you're moving through an environment, climbing, jumping, doing things like that, that's in a bunch mm-hmm. of games now. It's just that they tend to get folded into other genre. And part of that is back to when we were talking about whether it was going to be a cute mascot or Master Chief, the kind of maturing of the gaming audience itself. I remember business developers when you would pitch a game that would be like, hey, I want a game where you can fly a plane and you hop out and you hop in a car and you do stuff. You know, people were pitching ideas like that a long time ago. And the general wisdom was, oh, no, because then the airplane fans won't want to play your driving game. And that just doesn't happen. So I guess what I'm in a very, very long, drawn out way trying to say is that the genres never truly die. We just become, I think, better at folding them into each other to create these, you know, very lush, very, very rich hybrid experiences that have all of those things. So and then the other side of that is there is always that that reinvention that happens. So, yeah, RPGs were considered dead. Mm-hmm. RPGs. And then I remember the thing that really turned heads was Baldur's mm-hmm. Gate. Obviously, and MMOs were obviously already happening. There was Ultima and stuff like that. But, you know, they just kind of went through a kind of a slow phase, mm-hmm. I guess you'd say. And now, of course, you know, they're doing great and beloved. I'd say I don't think that moments happen for character platformers, not the classic ones. I mean, not coming back in a new way that brings in a giant new audience mm-hmm. yet. I think there have been some interesting attempts at that. I think as a laboratory, little indie studios that do that kind of stuff and try new ideas are going to be where that comes from. And they'll take that idea and they will leverage it and they will build bigger other things out of it. And, you know, and then, yeah, we'll see. It'll happen, mm-hmm. you know. But in the meantime, you can still see the kind of the fruits of the platformer genre in all kinds of games.
Oh, definitely. I mean, again, every one of these topics we're talking about, it's easily like an hour discussion, like in of itself.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, this is so fun.
But yeah, you are right about that. Like, one of the things as we really see, especially over the last decade, has been, again, this kind of combining or this melding pot of different genres and designs together, instead of just having a stealth game, and that's the only element of this game. Now, stealth is a major part of third-person shooters or first-person games.
Right.
And as you just said with platforming, the Uncharted series, Tomb Raider, again, like, it's one of those things that there's so many topics that my mind just blanks on them. But
Yeah. I mean, my favorite platformer in the last 10 years is probably Crackdown.
Yeah.
It is a great mm-hmm. platformer.
I know. And like something like Just Cause or Saints Row or Grand Theft Auto. Like, and that's the kind of thing. Like, again, like I said earlier, like the whole Metroidvania debate about is that or is that in a genre? You can look at something like Grand Theft Auto. Like, that really took this idea of it's not just a shooter, but it's also a driving game. Right. But it's not only a driving game, you fly planes, and it's not just this and that.
Yeah, all those cardinal rules that a lot of smart people thought should never be broken were totally broken, and it turns out it was great.
I know.
So,
all right. I know we are getting close to an hour and a half. So, again, if you're up to it, we could talk for hours upon hours. But do you have to get
– No, I've got to get back to work.
So
actually, I need lunch.
I know. I need to go get something to eat too. So we'll wrap things up, I guess – for tonight. But like I said, it was really great hanging out with you, Clayton, and hopefully we can do this again in the future.
Yeah,
awesome. I'd love to. So with that said, I have a few, I guess, wrap-up or final questions for you, and then we will say goodnight. So the first one is, obviously, we talked about this before the cast, but for the folks listening, is there anything that you're working on, anything that you have coming up that you would like to tease them for those listening?
Before
the suits come in and take.
I can't speak to any of the things at my my job at Microsoft. I am always working on my own independent stuff, which fortunately my employers are very cool with me doing. Nothing's quite ready there. I guess I still think along the lines of usually stuff that's bent and silly and kind of dumb, but that's just what I like.
All right. And I guess in terms of, again, we hit a lot of topics for this podcast. Is there anything that we didn't touch on or something you were thinking about that you would like to bring up now, before we say goodnight?
I think I left it all out there on the floor, man.
I know. It happens like that on these guests.
I think I talked so much, I worry that I didn't finish half of my thoughts, so I don't think I want to add to those right now.
And I guess with that, my final question for you is, do you have any final thoughts or anything you'd like to say to fans of Voodoo Vince or platformers or anything like that?
Thank you, I guess, to everyone who have been playing the game. I think I just spent an hour IMing with a player in Mexico yesterday who couldn't get through a puzzle.
Nice. So,
and due to my really poor Google Translate skills, I thought there was a bug or a problem with the puzzle. But in fact, no, he just wanted me to tell him how to solve the puzzle. So I thought that was hilarious. But the things I hear from the people playing have been so gratifying because it's a thing where, whatever theories or economics or whatever are involved in making a game, the people who attach themselves to it or who love it, that's kind of a really powerful lifelong relationship. And I don't know if I appreciated that when the game came out, but I hear from people who have these memories of, often of their families, their parents, other things that they associate with that game. So I think when it's all said and done, it's going to sound kind of trite, but that's what it's all about. And I'm really, really just kind of startled and amazed and gratified that the fans of the game have been so positive about it. And that's just really been great.
Awesome. And yeah, that level of transparency and being able to interact with your fans has certainly exploded with the rise of the independent space. And it's something that I hear from a lot of indie developers as well, as being able to connect with your audience is only one of the most rewarding parts of this industry.
Yeah, that is the biggest thing, I think, about the differences in the times we've been talking about here. I think it's great. It's been really enjoyable. Working with the fans.
Definitely. And again, that's another hour-long discussion easily. We start talking about that now. So with that said, we're going to wrap things up. I can feel my voice starting to die on me. So I think I got maybe three, 4 minutes of talking left. So we'll end things here. Clayton, it has been a pleasure hanging out with you today. And even though we can't tease anything upcoming, I do wish you the best of luck. And like I said, it will be great to have you back on either for another recording or maybe one of our live discussions.
Yeah, it sounds like fun. I'd love to do that.
So with that said, for those of you listening, we're going to end things here for this week's Perceptive Podcast. As always, if you'd like to support Game Wisdom, we have several options available. If you'd like to write a piece for the site or be a future guest for any of our discussions, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. Like I always say, if you like talking about game design, we can certainly make an afternoon or two about it. My email is josh@game-wisdom.com, and be sure to get in touch. You can follow me on Twitch and Twitter @GWBicer for updates throughout the day, as well as when I do my streams, be it through Let's Plays or having live developer interviews. You can find us on YouTube at the Game Wisdom YouTube channel for daily videos and vlogs on games and game design. And last but not least, if you like to support our Patreon campaign, you can find us on there under Game Wisdom or GWBicer. Any donations would be greatly appreciated in order to allow us to keep doing what we're doing, add more content, and you can get some great rewards as well. So with that said, my voice is just about dead. So thanks again for tuning in. Hope you enjoy this week's Perceptive Podcast. And have a great rest of the week. And we will talk to you again next time. Take care.